Coons versus Daniel Brownlee, DBA Restoration Specialties, Inc. Mr. Gibson.
Gibson, you don't argue race judicata or law of the case. Why?
Well, I think that the whole thing was decided by the Court of Appeals in 1995. And a whole, more than a whole year had gone by before the Court of Appeals again came along.
Well, but that wouldn't have anything to do with race judicata or law of the case. Why didn't you argue that it's already been decided?
Well, I thought you argued that
Doesn't seem to be correct. In that you suggest there, you say where the trial court finds that the defendant's workmanship does not meet community standards, ordinary care, and residential construction. That the court didn't find that. Did it? The trial court never found that. Did they? Did it, counsel? It didn't make that actual finding that the contractor here, that his workmanship did not meet community standards of ordinary care. Did the trial court actually find that?
I think he said the same thing. I think the same thing. That's where we are. I don't think this is concerning the investigation of majority judge, second time up.
Is there any law, proposition of law to be determined from your case?
Well, I think it's the court of appeals decided the case more than a year went by, and not the other three side of the case without even arguing.
Well, if you even had argued that, then that would have exposed some error under some very well established law, the principle of law of the case. It would not have really add to the law in Ohio, would it, counsel?
I hope if they had presidential thing is right.
We already have that precedent in our book, don't we?
You do have that precedent, but I think it must probably be called attention to the fact again.
Okay.
That's what I think this is all about. I guess when I'm up, I should have discussed that. Well, that case, right, and I'm going to quote back this, about whether or not you have mandates to tell the people that are praised properly that it should be ordered, mentioning I have mandates to do this. Well, that's what the statute already said for me. What did we add to it by issuing an order of mandates that that's what you're supposed to do, you know? I couldn't understand how I'm going to send them. But that's a second point. I think that occasionally you have to come up and emphasize to people that that's what you got to do. And I think that's what this case is pretty about. It should be emphasized and worked. Sometimes your court will say one way, your path is that only it.
Thank you, Mr. Gibson. Mr. Losey.
Thank you, Your Honor. Like Mr. Gibson, I think I'll be brief. I think this case is actually much more simple than its procedural history would indicate. This is a matter where the trial court made factual findings based on the weight it assigned to the evidence and the testimony that occurred and in assessing its own credibility. And through an aberration on this first appeal, great injustice was done to the standard that requires the Court of Appeals to defer to the determinations of weight and credibility.
What if either or both parties had substantially relied on that decision and had conducted their business affairs in accordance with that decision? Would your position still be the same, that a subsequent panel of the Court of Appeals could come back and undo all that?
Your Honor, I think I would take the position that once the injustice is done, you cannot unring the bell, simply because reliance may have occurred on the basis of that does not make that reliance into a self-virtuous, especially if it's relying upon, as I would argue, a horrible aberration in the law of appellate review.
So part of the second appellate decision could have said, and any action you've taken pursuant to that original decision of this court, including the transfer of property, the division of assets, whatever it might be, can all be undone. And it has to be undone.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that the court had that matter before, but I suppose theoretically it would require a different cause of action, although it escaped me as to whom it would be against, as if you're doing a reliance there. But I would argue that to some degree, the law and procedure is in place such that it does try to at least freeze the affairs of parties while litigation is continuing. I think that's recognized, the ability to seek stays of execution.
There was no stay here in either of the cases.
And perhaps, you know, parties do so at their own risk at that point. If procedural protections that exist are not exercised, that's really up to the parties, I worry.
Well, in this case, I thought that the builder here was partway through the job, and there was a dispute, builder left the job and the job was completed by someone else. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so it's a question of damages. How much does the customer or the person getting the house built get to recover from your client? Isn't that essentially what the issue is? Damages?
The issue that was appealed.
I mean, that's not the legal. I mean, the legal issue is, there's another legal issue, but isn't that, factually, that's all there is before the trial court and the court appeals, wasn't there?
On the second time around, are you referring, Your Honor, to the trial court hearing prior to the second appellate decision?
Well, I thought the only issue was whether the home owner here was entitled to recover damages from your client.
The case was remanded originally for that determination.
Right. But there weren't any reliance issues. There weren't any other related sort of issues here, were there, that the trial court or court appeals had to deal with?
No, the court didn't consider that any further. The damages issue, I would argue that the damages issue perhaps is oversimplified when the trial court considered the damages.
Well,
that's really beside the point, too.
Sure.
I think that what happened was that on the second appeal, I think that the appellate court simply corrected its mistake, which I think the law allows it to do. I think it could be argued very easily that perhaps there are reliance problems and you need to seal the deal and let people get on with their lives, but I think begs the question of the quality of justice that would be visited upon a person who relies upon a decision that represents, as I would argue, a horrible aberration in appellate review.
I think I vote to review the case in the merits, not for the procedural issue, but for the standard of determining this community standard issue. I thought that was the issue that was, at least it was interesting to me, and there's not much here on that, I find now. Do you wish to argue that?
Your Honor, I think the reason why there's not much there is because it's fairly well settled. I believe that the standard is reasonable workmanlike quality. In the absence of an agreement by the parties to deviate from that standard or to elevate it or to increase it, I believe Judge Bryant's decision cites a case that dates back to 1897. It's my understanding that the standard hasn't really changed that much since then. And in fact, as recently as the the site escaped me. I believe it's 1986 case. It's in the cited brief. I believe the standard remains relatively the same. I think that I don't think that in any of those cases there's a talismanic community standard that has to be obeyed. I think obviously that evidence of community standards certainly is relevant to determination of ordinary, most reasonable, but just one factor, Your Honor. And I would also argue that the record in this case reflects that Mr. Brownlee didn't meet those ordinary standards, albeit in a different way. I think he just was finding more than one way to skin a cat. He and Mr. Westerman were both trying to achieve the same end for the destruction, just performed a different manner.
What proposition of law do you see the court actually presented with this appeal?
I think this...
We only have the one that's argued. I mean, that's presented from the appellant. Is there a proposition of law within that we can address?
Your Honor, when this case made it up to this court, I could not figure out why, other than the tortured procedural history, I thought perhaps it presented a red flag to this court. But I think that procedural history is easily answered when one looks at the need for the appellate court to rectify it. It's wrong. But I do think that one issue that did jump out that I thought perhaps might be worth noting is I noticed that the court had visited the issue of law of the case in 1996 decision, and thought perhaps that this court perhaps viewed this case as an opportunity to expound upon that doctrine. which to my knowledge hadn't been visited that frequently prior to the 1996 case, and cited in my brief, and thought perhaps that a distinction could be made about the application of the law of the case doctrine that should differ under a manifest way of the evidence sort of situation as opposed to a case involving misapplication of the law.
And we don't have any briefing on that issue.
Your Honor, I did cite Campbell versus Crist.
But it's not briefed as the issue here. We've not been told that there needs to be any change in that decision.
That's true, Your Honor. I admit that I only included it just in case. I did not see that as a feature issue in this case. I did think that it was a relevant consideration. I think it was an obstacle that had to be addressed on the way to getting to the ultimate decision in this case, and that's why I included that. But I do believe that Campbell versus Crist does include some useful precedent insofar as there is dicta that I believe suggests that law of the case may not be applicable in a situation such as this, where public courts are simply determining their own facts rather than determining the standard to be applied to the facts. If it pleases the court, and there are no further questions from the bench,
thank you, Mr. Losey. Mr. Gibson, you've saved 8 minutes of your time. Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.